sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The S&P posts the best monthly gain since 2011. Apple's up $66 billion in market cap just in February alone. And we have more rate cuts, more global stimulus, much more central bank activity. We'll talk about this and much more on episode number 402 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. That's right, you heard it right. One of the best months ever for the S&P 500. NASDAQ, Dow screamed higher on all of that stimulus that we saw that started in the beginning of this year. Actually, probably in the mid part of January, things started to get a little crazy with central banks really ramping it up. Anyway, I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm your host. Thanks for joining me. We had a great episode last week talking about some of the nuances and the new ways of social media helping the world. And I thought that was really interesting, our discussion. And I was thinking about it a lot throughout the week as I was tweeting away, as I was looking at the various blog posts and talking about the podcast that we're going to do, thinking about some of the discussions I've had with others on how social media is really transforming things, some for the good, some for the bad. And I looked at some of the stocks out there, looking at how a lot of the buzz these days in terms of the NASDAQ is all about Facebook. It's about Twitter to a degree. Talking about some of the change that Google's making. And, of course, Apple now coming out with the watch. And one of the things that their watch seems to have, from what we could see in some of the pre-release information on the Apple site itself, is a bit of, we'll call it social networking, or at least social ability, where you can tap on your watch and possibly someone else's watch will feel that pulse when it comes across. As Apple says, it's, well, you're thinking about them. You can actually hold down two fingers and you'll be able to register your heartbeat and then send that to somebody. I'm not sure what the benefit of that is, unless they're a cardiologist or something. But at least there is some of this interactive mechanisms going on with the watch, as you would expect from Apple, and in a world that is so well connected from a social standpoint. But the Apple stock is still on a tear. Not yet reached the pre-split price of 1,000, but getting very close. I think you have to get to about 142 for that. So we're getting up there. Stock came back a little bit after a nice run throughout February. Last couple of days of February didn't do so well. But the market cap did increase by about $66 billion. And that's the size of a small company with a country, you would think. I mean, that's a pretty substantial move on a stock. $66 billion of added cap rate. The capitalization of the stock, just multiplying the shares outstanding times the price of the shares, and you get a $66 billion move. Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive. One of the things you'll also notice is that that move, that excess or additional market capitalization, increases the size of Apple. And what does that mean? Well, since the S&P 500 is a market cap weighted index, and because the NASDAQ 100, for example, is market cap weighted as well, it has a disproportionate amount of movement that can be attributable to Apple. So, for example, when we look at the movement of the NASDAQ 100, clearly the 100 largest stocks in the NASDAQ, and the number one stock is Apple, but Apple holds about a 12% or so positioning in that particular index. So that means that if Apple is up 1% just by itself, that adds 12 basis points to the index, or 13 basis points around there. I think it holds about a 3% positioning in the S&P 500, still a very disproportionately large amount of movement that can be attributable to Apple. And unfortunately right now, due to the fact that the way it is derived, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, there is no way to change that. You can do and look at things like an alternative index. You can look at the equal weighted S&P 500 to see how things are going. Not that it's that much different. The Dow Jones is a price weighted. So Apple, which is not in the Dow Jones, would have a weighting that is at the 130 level. But you look at things like Visa, IBM, those have a very disproportionate amount of potential movement in terms of the points on the Dow, as is the same thing with Apple. But it is right now the condition that we live in that we have these disproportionate amounts of, that should probably be the word for the show, amount of movement that is predicated on something that is very concentrated. The other thing that we have to look at is how the central banks have been really pushing things around pretty dramatically. We know the ECB is getting ready, ever so ready, just on the edge of, so close, about to, almost there. Seems like they're always almost there, never really there. About to release some of the bond buying that they had said they were going to do recently, buying up some of the sovereign bonds around the European region. And we're going to see how they actually do some of this, because a lot of questions out there. They're going to buy an equal amount. They're going to buy an amount that is based on the levels that they don't have. For example, if they have a lot of outstanding debt at that they bought up through through Greece and maybe Italy, are they going to buy Germany's? Are they going to buy France's? You know, how is this all going to work? So there's a question as to what the mechanism is, and that has been something that has been very much concerning for some time now. But that is, nonetheless, that's going to start very soon. We're going to see some of that going on. Already, Germany has, listen to this, Germany has negative yields. They just sold their 5 years at a negative yield. What does that mean? Well, simply, you have to pay the German government for the pleasure of owning their bonds. So the government bonds are, now, what will happen is they sold it above par and such a level so high that while you may get some interest rates on some of it, the fact is when it matures, you're going to lose money on it. So there's a negative net yield on that. Why would anybody do that? Who knows? But because of this amount of pressure that the ECB is putting on and has talked about and that they are anticipating doing in terms of buying the stock, the bonds of the various sovereigns, the markets are working well ahead of them. The good news for the ECB is that a lot of their hard work has been accomplished already just by the fact they talked about it. Rhetoric, or some call it communications policy. Either way, the fact is that right now we have such low rates in the European region, and a lot of that is, again, because of the fact that the ECB has been talking it up pretty well. In fact, what's really interesting is, while you would think that yields should be somewhat lower because of what they're doing, it's interesting to note that the yields in the U.S. are much higher. Now, that can be because we have a much better economy, to a degree. But still, the risk factors of what is going on is where we're finding a major divergence. Because the risk factors on the bonds of U.S., let's say, versus the bonds of the ECB or many of the countries within the ECB are much different. There's a much higher degree or probability, if you were to spec this out, of a default, of a slowing down of an economy, of a withdrawal of some of the countries inside of the ECB compared to the sovereignty and the sovereign bonds of the US. So investors are really stretching it right now. They're really going a little bit crazy looking for yield, and that's why we're seeing that we have such an incredible rush into European bonds right now, because there is the whole idea that right behind the investor is going to be the European Central Bank with their bond buying program, the quantitative easing, as they call it. And our bank, our central bank, is saying, well, we're going to be raising rates soon. And therefore, a lot of players don't want to be invested in these bonds. But even when there was really no sign of a significant or imminent rate increase, our bonds, for a while, for the last number of months, still yielding much higher than it was in Europe. And again, just think about it. Just a risk reward. Wouldn't you rather have a bond of a country that is strong, and you're going to have to give up some of your yield to do so, than have a bond of a country or a company that is weak, And you're going to say, you know what, because of that, I'm going to have to require that you pay me more money. Simple supply, demand, simple credit basics, where you have the whole idea that, well, there's going to be a bigger demand for those countries that are stronger to a degree. And also the reality is that the risk is there for many of the bonds that are outside of the quality areas. And those always yield higher, junk, high yield, et cetera. That's not happening. We have such a distorted policy right now around the world. Just this week, China has lowered its rate on the major rate for the central bank by the second time in the last 3 months. They made weaker the reference rate on the yuan, their currency, to a two-year low. Now what's going to happen is, I'll tell you right now, you're going to see all the guys in Congress start marching out with the old, oh, I got this letter in my pocket. China's a currency manipulator, blah, 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 blah. Because now what's going to happen is the dollar has been really rallying, although it had a not such a great month in February, but the dollar has been rallying for a number of months on the heels of, again, it's all about the Fed. It's kind of boring. It's kind of annoying. It's kind of disheartening and disconcerting that all we have to really peg everything on is the Fed. It wasn't like this, people. Just to clarify something, I've been doing this a long time. It wasn't always like this. The Fed was not always in your face every single day. And if it wasn't the Fed here in the United States, it's the Fed in Europe, or we have Denmark, or we have Sweden, or we have, in Brazil. It's a constant situation where the various central banks are just seemingly feel that they are the only ones. Well, let me say this differently. Not they're the only ones to actually help and support markets. They believe that they are in charge of markets directions and economic directions. We already know, by the way, very clearly, by every single metric we could see, that there has been no real benefit to economies from all this quantitative easing. I mean, yes, we see a much better unemployment rate. We see a lot of things. A lot of that would have happened already. It's the low interest rate environment that really helps. And the fact is that right now, it doesn't look like any of these central banks can really get out of this low interest rate environment for a very long time, if ever. They're kind of trapped right now. Because if they start raising rates, it's going to hurt all their bond purchases. They set themselves up and they did a bit of a checkmate because they own all of these bonds. And if they start raising rates, they're going to lose money on it. Now, mind you, yes, they'll hold it to maturity. They'll hold all their bond holdings to maturity. That wasn't the plan, by the way. But they have no choice. They really didn't think it through, I don't think. Because if they start selling off their bonds, they're going to cave in the markets. And with an increasing interest rate environment, it's going to cave in even further. And then there all of a sudden is this massive amount of supply on the market. And it just keeps on going round and round. You're going to have a big problem with sovereign bonds. You're going to see a major cave in. When that happens, it may or may not. Because if they hold these to maturity and just let these bleed off naturally out of their portfolio for 20 or 30 years or 15 years, however long the average duration is and maturity of these bonds, well then, okay, let it do it. But if they were to do by plan, buy bonds temporarily in order to bring down prices, to bring down the value of the currency, and then the natural progression of reversing that, which is what they plan to do, not going to happen. Impossible to happen. Especially now that a lot of countries around the world have embarked on very similar types of programs. If nothing else, everybody's in a currency war. There's a great couple of pieces out over the last few weeks about this whole currency war thing. And there's a nice study that a client sent me from Citi that happened last week. And a big discussion was, you know, who wins this whole currency war? And at the end of the day, there is no winner here. But there is a problem because central banks really are in a situation where they have more quote-unquote bullets, they have more ammunition, they really don't have a lot of punch with it. In other words, while they have all these things they can do, it was very clear that the most bang for the buck in terms of the quantitative easing programs was QE1. No question about that. QE2, twist, QE3, QE infinity, much less return on their efforts. Because what happens is, you know, the compression gets much, much smaller, where you could take rates down from 7%, let's say, to 0%, and you can take your currency down from whatever level down 20%. Well, that last little part where they're trying to keep this whole thing going and keep all the all the balls in the air and the plates spinning all at the same time, it really didn't add a lot of incremental benefit to the price of the currency and bringing it down, or really bonds. And right now, where we are is just in a holding pattern. And this is going to play out. And we know this, by the way. We knew this beforehand. We didn't have to wait to see this. We saw what happened with Japan. Japan has been on a quantitative easing program, massive stimulus, and they have been on a program for the last 20-something years. Even with the most recent move by Kurata and by Shinzo Abe to try to get inflation up, they can't do it. Now they're blaming it on oil. They may have to change their actual inflation statistics so they can actually retrofit the idea of meeting their goals by changing it, because they don't like how things are going right now. They don't like the fact that, well, energy and food is included, and, well, it's dropped off pretty dramatically due to the fact that oil prices have dropped. So, you know, if at first it doesn't succeed, well, they just change the rules. Whereas, I guess that was a great movie by Jerry Lewis. I think it was Jerry Lewis. Don't raise the bridge, lower the water. You know, this is the whole idea. You know, if you can't get your water filtration system to meet the criteria of FDA or whatever it may be in terms of the pollutants, well, just change the rules. And there, everybody passes. This is kind of where we are right now with central banks. They're going to have to start changing the rules, because at this point, we're not making it. They're not really helping anything further, and they can't reverse what they've done. So there we go. Now, one of the things that I think is really interesting about, we started to talk about a couple of podcasts ago, and there's some images that I'm going to leave on the show notes for this episode, is the whole idea that the economic surprise index has really been coming in pretty sharply. And what does that mean? It's the same thing as earnings missing dramatically. So analysts now will go out and start to adjust their numbers. But really the point that I'm making here is there are two things lining up that are pretty scary. Or three things. Let's start out with number one, stock markets at all-time highs. Why? Well, we just talked about some of that. It really isn't about earnings. It really isn't about anything else except for the momentum and a lot of liquidity in the markets. Because if you look at earnings, really that the outlook for earnings by analysts and by companies, who, by the way, we know will do some sandbagging, will do a little bit of a little posturing to make sure they beat by a penny or two. But if you look at the actual earnings estimates by all accounts for the S&P 500, we're talking about a 6% drop in EPS over the next quarter or so. A 6% drop. That change, by the way, came, and the adjustments came in the beginning of January through where we are today. That 6% drop is in the face of a market that advanced 5% for the month of February at all-time highs. PE on the S&P 500 is about 18.7 right now. Some of that can be said that, okay, well, we're in a low interest rate environment, so some of that's deserved. But still, the average is about 16 and change. So now we have a 16 and change. We have the PE at 18. That's unestimated, by the way. And the fact is that when we look at where we are in terms of estimated, it's a little bit toppy here. Little toppy. Because analyst estimates have been coming down so dramatically. And the dollar rallying is hurting a lot of the big names. And there was some crazy statistic that we recently talked about that 50% of the growth in earnings in the S&P 500 was due to Apple. That's pretty scary. If you take out Apple from that. Now, one of the things that really has been very pronounced is if you watch markets and you see what happens on the open during the day and you see what happens during the day, there's a clear and obvious push into futures, into massive ETFs, etc. Because SPY, for example, S&P futures, are really pushing markets around pretty well. You can see this when you look at things like the tick on the major markets on the NYSE. You can look at this on like a very short-term chart when you start looking and looking back over the day, when you're seeing what happened during the day, and look at like a 10-minute chart where you see this big drop and you see the reversal back up. The algorithms right now are looking to grab any incremental move that happens in the market. And right now, a lot of that, again, is due to many of the big stocks that are out there, but more so about the futures and ETFs. And that's a concern of mine, because if we start to have a move of futures that are buying in so dramatically, remember, they're highly leveraged, highly margined. If you start seeing that reversal happen, or if you see that there is going to be a change in the dynamic of earnings in stocks, will we see people still wanting to put money in the S&P 500? And how out of whack will many of those companies that are not performing as well as, let's say, an Apple, how are they going to fare with investors moving forward? There's a very big concern I have right there. If you've watched many of the earnings results, there's also a clear optimistic view of things. I'll give you an example of two that happened. One in particular probably is I think this will encapsulate it. This happened actually Thursday night to Friday. Herbalife came out with earnings, symbol HLF. They came out with their earnings, and they had a pretty good number. And don't forget, a lot of players out there have been selling and shorting and talking down the company. There's a whole idea of it being a multi-level marketing. And, you know, you got the big boys out there on the short side of things, right? Well, the stock has come down for some time, and it looks pretty lousy, the chart. Well, after the earnings come out, you see that the stock takes a move about 8% higher or so in the aftermarket. Now, I started looking at the earnings results, and one of the things that stuck out to me was that management guided a terrible, absolutely terrible guidance, like something like 15 to 17% reduction in their earnings in the next quarter or so and outward. They look at the annual. It was just, the whole outlook looked really abysmal, just absolutely abysmal. And I said to myself, now, there is something to be said about a company who is sandbagging and a company who is trying to be conservative and looking at what's going on in terms of their outlook and being, okay, you know what, gang, don't get too excited. Don't get crazy about things, because you know what, we're seeing that, well, maybe the dollar and maybe something's happening in China and maybe the dynamic of our mix and clientele, and okay, and they kind of guide down. These guys guided down very significantly. And after that, you saw all the headlines how HLF beat and the stock was really moving higher and it moved up by 8%. So now, meanwhile, I'm scratching my head there saying, something's not right. You know, you look a bit further than the headline and you look into the actual performance and outlook, and you look at all the smaller items here, even just one layer down. I'm not saying getting down and dirty into all the financials, but just looking at all of the financials and then the outlook, you have to say, my gosh, this looks really awful. And meanwhile, the stock is rallying, and you're thinking to yourself, well, maybe there was some expectations or, you know, okay, well, here's the punchline to the story. The next day, the stock ended up down about, I think about 7 or 8% on that. And there was, again, a headline news media is just awful. But there was headline numbers that came out without any kind of substance underneath it. So investors were just buying it. So this optimism was there. We saw this massive optimism because the headline number, oh, they beat, let's just buy and be done with it. And then the next day, reality hit. Now, I think reality is going to hit the next day coming soon. Now, I have been very cautious for the last few weeks, several weeks. I actually was cautious probably, I would say probably January, February. February took me by a big surprise. Now, good news was we were only hedged ever so slightly with our portfolios. We had a good month. Didn't have the same month as the markets per se in our core strategy of TDI managed growth, but Aero did very well. Our global allocations did very well. The good news was that TDI was hedged really hard in January, so the good news is we didn't lose the money that was lost in the markets in January. But the point is here, what's going to happen in March? What's going to happen when we wake up and the reality hits us right in the face, that we see a slowdown occurring? We see a slowdown occurring in many of the markets, many of the regions, many of the areas around the country, the manufacturing, factory orders. We saw a guiding down for GDP was guided down, or the second revision was taken down to 2.4%, I believe it was, 2.5%. And when you look at the global factors that are really playing out and how that's going to go, well, we have a global slowdown that is just undeniable. We have a dollar that is rising. So now you have a dollar that's rising, makes it much more difficult to export, plus a global slowdown. How does that all work? How do you have foreign countries and other players and companies around the world with a lower currency that would have to cost more to buy what is being made and exported in the U.S. when they don't need the materials anyway? Copper. You know, Dr. Copper, they say that copper is one of the major things that you want to look at. Have you looked at a chart lately? Not looking so healthy. And also the inventories this weekend in copper were the largest they've been in 3 years. In other words, they have a glut of copper. Nickel imports plunged entirely and just absolutely, we saw this weekend, just plunged over the last several months. So we start adding this all up. Let's see. We have a global slowdown. We have oil that's doing something very funky. We have a million barrels a day all of a sudden, right? I mean, it's like, hello, just want to let you know, 6 months ago, we have all this excess oil. Well, where'd that come from? How all of a sudden do we have all this excess oil? It's not like we have all this, you know, solar-powered cars and wind-powered cars and transportation and all these electric vehicles that are really just making it so that it's not necessary to have fuel anymore, gasoline, petroleum products. But wait a minute. Why all of a sudden do we have a million barrels a day? Is it because in the Middle East they're keeping up production? Well, yes, but still, that was the production. So they can cut production, but why all of a sudden do we have all this excess? Now we're seeing we have excess of copper, major inventory build. We're seeing that nickel is plunging. We're seeing that a lot of commodities are really getting hurt. We're seeing that the economic surprise index is rolling over very hard. And countries are stimulating like all of a sudden there's a major breakdown. Like there's an imminent crash occurring with economic activity. You know, you got to wonder what's going on. What are we not hearing? Why all of a sudden is the United States the only place in the world that is looking great? Or is it something else? I would say to you, if you take a look at much of the data that's out there, the economic indicators, one at a time, look at the important ones. Look at factory orders. Look at manufacturing. And look at some of the regionals, but look at the ISM. Look at the the overall GDP, but where is all the growth coming from? Look at retail sales. How they've slowed down pretty dramatically. Look at durable goods, you know, the major transports. Nothing really pleasant there. And then I think I really do think it's important to realize that I think we've hit a plateau in housing. That doesn't mean that housing is going to crash. I'm not even talking about pricing. I'm just talking about the building process. I'm talking about the new home sales, existing home sales. Even though we saw pending home sales do really well recently, but new home sales and existing home sales are not like doing anything so dramatic that we're back to the big numbers. As a matter of fact, in certain areas around the country, the existing home sales are disproportionately doing very well. In other areas, it's doing terrible. We have a lot more inventory that has been put on the market that all of a sudden we don't see anymore, and the inventory is down dramatically. So maybe we've gone through a cycle. That's the important thing here. I want you to remember something right now. I want you to remember this. Everything cycles. If you think that, well, markets are going to go up forever, everything cycles. Well, the real estate market is all the way down, and look at that. It's, oh my God, we have a major crash. Everything cycles. Okay? You have to remember that in terms of economics, there is no surefire way, even though every time we get to the point that we think we're at the worst case, it's never going to get better. Something happens. We get stimulus by the Fed. Something breaks around the world. Currencies come down. Things start to kind of, all right, to settle out and things turn around. Then we get to the point where economics are great. Unemployment is really rolling. We got some decent GDP. And everybody thinks, you know what? Finally, we're not going to ever have a recession again. And then what happens? We cycle. Because it's just like what you see in the stock market. There's enthusiasm, greed, and fear. The greed and fear is the big categories you need to look at here, because when you look at markets, when you look at economies, when you look at jobs, people act very emotionally when it comes to finances, comes to outlook. We try to think positive. You know, you try to think as positive as possible. We're trained to think, you know, the good side. We're trained to think the glass is half full, not half empty. Trying to say, oh yeah, there's some green shoots over there. That is kind of part and parcel of what we are. Otherwise, we're going to just be depressive, miserable people that, you know, we're just going to be out there, each one of us, contemplating, you know, how to off ourselves. The fact is we need to think about things getting better into the future. For those that think only things will get worse, and you have your bunkers and you have your shotguns and your, you know, carry, you have your concealed weapon permit that you carry around. Oh, that's great. And you know that you are you know, constantly looking at things like, oh my gosh, it's a conspiracy. Come on, let's back off a little bit here. It's not that bad either. So there's two sides to this. One side being greed, one side being fear, and both are in constant conflict on a daily basis. When we get to the point of being so greedy, we'll call it, where we saw that people were flipping houses and doubling down and banks were being greedy, well, we know that that is a very bad situation. Are we there? We're not there when it comes to the same things. And oftentimes in markets, you don't see the same things happen that will replicate themselves. So we're not going to see another housing crash that just ruins everything. We're not going to see maybe a technology bubble with the IPOs that we saw back in 2000 ruining everything. We're not going to see a currency debacle like we saw with long-term capital management and the whole thing just went out the window in terms of markets like we saw. Something else. Maybe it's going to be China. We saw Ebola really ruin things for a bit. That's kind of off the radar these days. But you have to look at what's the next thing that could be cyclical. And by the way, I'm not talking about from only a whole market standpoint. Well, look at what happened with oil. That was cyclical. 2 years ago, everybody said, oh my gosh, we're going to run out of oil. Everybody says now we have too much oil and it's going down to $20 or $10 a barrel. And if you look at the companies involved in that whole sector, they've got obliterated. So the cycle can be either when we're looking at things like yields. Look at what happened to the utilities. Down 7% for the month, the utility index. For February, wiping out essentially 1.5 to 2 years worth of dividends and yield that was paid on those. Utilities were just doing incredibly well for some time. And then everybody's scratching their head saying, wait a minute, if the markets are so good, if the economy is so good, if things are going well, and why are utilities rallying? This is going on the last year or so. Why do we see REITs rallying, real estate investment trusts? Why is all this? Because there's a search for yield. You've been forced into that. You can't put money into a bank account at 0.001% if you're trying to live on some of your money. Think about the people that had all that money in banks and would use that at 4 or 5%, roll their CDs on a regular basis so they can pay for their food, they can pay for their various payments of electricity, of car, of movies, of all the things that go on for life, for especially for seniors. How are they doing that? How? They're eating into their principal. You think that they want to be involved in markets? They have to be to a degree. But is it right? Is it the right risk factors? That's a question. I think it's very interesting. So let's just sum up this whole discussion here, which got a little bit elongated. With the whole idea is that central banks are really pushing things right now and things are getting a little bit stretched. We're seeing that even though they have done so over the last number of years, that each and every time they do a little bit more, it gets that much less effective. And as we're seeing, it can become that much less effective and maybe even at a point where we're going to see a reversal of some of the central bank tendencies in the U.S., while many of the ones outside of the U.S. are still doing a lot of easing. The fact is that when we look at economics in the U.S., we're seeing a lot of negative surprises. We're seeing that the world itself is slowing down. We're seeing that commodities are taking the brunt of it, which could be the canary in the coal mine on this whole thing. And we're seeing the fact that markets are hitting a high. So there's a divergence of what's going on here. And it looks to me that when you slice it all down and you put it all together, if the economics continue to soften and if we see the commodities continue to be weak, that is the winning factor there and stocks will follow. So just a point of reference on all that. One of the things that we had talked about last week was the whole idea that, well, Greece is supposedly agreeing to some of the deals and the requirements of the Eurozone in response and getting about a four-month bailout. Now, I talked about how I thought this was a bunch of crap, and I talked about it in particular on the DH Unplugged podcast. If you haven't listened to that, you got to take a listen to that. And as a matter of fact, in the little game we play, I even said you got to short the Greek stock market through an ETF. Now, one of the things that has happened and we've seen is that there's been massive protests in the street of Greece, because what happened was that this populist leader got elected and he promised, he said, you know what, we are going to say basically to all of those people out there that put us in this situation where we have unemployment rate of over 50% for those 25 and younger. We have a massive amount of interest that we have to pay. We're constrained. We're in a recession of our own, or depression for that matter, not getting out of it. And there's no way out of this ever. We basically given the big finger to these guys and tell them, you know what? Take your bailouts and go shove it. And if they don't like it, we're leaving. We're leaving the Eurozone. We're leaving the Euro. Well, they tried that for a little while. And then the Eurozone said, you know what, guys, hold on. You owe us a lot of money. And you know what? You're about to run out of money. And if you want any more money before you run out in the next 3 or 4 weeks, abide by our plan. Well, they hemmed and hawed. They walked out of meetings and all this. And in the end, they pretty much gave in. Greece pretty much caved. Okay. But now, behind the scenes, when they get back and they have to ratify this, there's a lot of problems. And there's now massive protests in the street. There's also fires that are going on, cars being set up on fire, and all problems in Athens, and people are pissed off, and rightfully so. Maybe not so much to go that far, but okay, they should have the right to be mad about what happened here, because you know they should be mad at their leader is who they should be mad at, not the Eurozone. Eurozone's just saying, hey, just do what we told you to do because you agreed to this, and we're just kind of trying to plot along and get our money back, make sure that you stay within the plan so that you can get your country back to, being economically viable. So now, there's all these protests. Now the question is going to be, is are they going to default on their loans to the IMF, another party that put their money into them? And how is that going to go? And if, in fact, this is even going to be anything great, because now all we did was give them more money and have 4 months to get more problems and possibly even more planning time to pull out. So this was really, I think, a bad idea. It was a bad idea for Greece to cave, but it was actually brilliant on their half because they got all this money in. It gives them more time to pretty much do what they want and figure out how to screw the EU. Now, mind you, if you take a look at like National Bank of Greece, NBG, and you look at Greek, G-R-E-K, two symbols there, those two symbols are representative of some of the major trading opportunities. Now, I made the mistake. I actually went short for client accounts, National Bank of Greece, when it was soaring that day when the whole thing was put through. And I said, this is not going to hold. Now, I put a stop level where I said, you know, we're out of this. And I hit that stop. It wasn't a very big, I wasn't going to let it move very, very much because it moves very quickly. It's a very cheap stock. But now if you look back on it, let's say it was $2 we stopped out of it. I think it was about a 10-cent move. Not a big deal. But, you know, I wasn't going to let this thing really run away from me if, in fact, it was something different than I thought it was. Meanwhile, it's about 170 right now. That's 30 cents. That's 15% drop or so since that. And if you look at Greek, G-R-E-K, that's the symbol for the ETF, what you'll find is that that's been dropping and dropped on Friday pretty dramatically. As a matter of fact, I think National Bank of Greece was down Friday about 8% or 9% or so, and the Greek markets were down pretty well also. And this is all because of the reality is now setting in. Just like what we talked about before, everything cycles. This is a quick one. Reality setting in that, well, Greece took that four-month reprieve. They're taking possibly getting some money in if they go along with the plans here. But in the end of the day, they really don't want to go along with the plans. So they're pretty much fleecing the EU if they get any of the money and they can do with this what they want to. So I would keep a watch on that because I do not think that this situation has simmered down. As a matter of fact, I think it just got worse because now what's going to happen is there's 4 months more of uncertainty. And because when they went back to Greece to ratify this, there was so much of an uproar and there was so much of controversy about this that I don't think that this leader can survive if he's going to just pander to whatever the EU says. Now, I don't think that Greece can really survive either if they just go along with whatever is being said by the EU because, you know, it's going to break their backs. But they can't survive without it either. They're in a no-win situation. The entire European region is in a no-win situation. So keep your eye on that. I think it's very important to watch what the developments are in Greece. But I just do not think that anything is good going to come out of this. Now, is this the end of the world? Again, it is not a problem from an economic standpoint. We talked about this the last two podcasts. Listen to that if you haven't. We went into depth about some of this. It's not a major problem for the rest of the world in terms of the economics involved in it. It's a problem for Europe, which then is a problem for the rest of the world. So keep that in mind. I think that's very important. The other thing I want to mention to you is if you've been following along on some of our discussion about, for example, that I was so adamant on the short side of looking at GoPro, GPRO. Now, one of the things about GoPro that I said, and this was before the beginning of the year, that the next earnings announcement probably is going to be a very good one, but I'm concerned about the following ones after that. And I also mentioned there's a lot of competition. Well, one of the things that happened last week was that the company Xiaomi, which is a major distributor of smartphones in China, probably the number one distributor, now looks like they're going to announce a little competitor to GoPro. Well, that's a problem. That will pretty much lock GoPro out of China. And then the reality about them not able to really do anything about monetization in the area of social media. When YouTube isn't even profitable, how are they going to be profitable in this area? So the whole GoPro thing is, it's getting to a point that unfortunately I would have liked to kept it short. We closed it for a really nice gain. And I think that now we're into a major potential area where there's some support here, but it's getting very, very ugly. So we talked about Greek, GoPro, and National Bank of Greece as well. There's a couple of the stocks I want to talk about. I want to talk about the biotech area. Have you been watching the... It's humorous. Have you been watching some of this? I'm not talking about the big guys like the Biogens, or the Celgenes. So have you looked at some of these small guys? I mean, they're moving. They're really moving. Reminds me of a time back in a number of years ago where the same kind of situation was happening, that there was a lot of takeovers going on, a lot of new drug candidates that were coming out, a lot of good news out of the FDA. And I would keep my eye on some of these small biotechs. Now, do I have any names? Not really. I'm not going to give you – this area is total speculation. But I will tell you that I want to share with you all of the idea that all the mergers that we saw take place in the biotechs over the last year and a half or so, and due to inversions, due to patent cliff runoffs, due to the fact that companies trying to get growth at any way possible – I think you need to start looking, and we talked about this, and just start making a really good watch list on the oil companies. Many of the smaller plays, because the big guys, if this persists for some time and oil prices to continue to move down, they're going to need growth. They're going to look at players out there that can give them some growth. And it's a little bit different in the biotech world, but still, you got the big guys and the little guys. Think about that. And the big guys buying the little guys for growth and for opportunity. And I think that in the area of the U.S. where you have many of these proven reserves, I think there's a great opportunity. So, again, I've given you some of those names before, talking about something like Triangle Petroleums, Whiting Petroleum, Oasis. There's a lot of different companies out there that could be very beneficial. What's really interesting to look at is the refiners, and some of these refiners, like Western Refiners, which we hold, WNR. Man, that stock has been on fire. Just doing really, it's looking pretty good. I got to tell you something. Over the last several weeks, we've owned them for, I don't know, probably about 40% right here. So pretty interesting. And as we talked about the whole idea of takeovers and all, you have to look at Monster Beverage. Came out with great earnings. I mean, spectacular earnings. And things are going really well for them after that massive problem they saw a few years ago where there was a big hoo-ha about energy drinks. And Monster Beverage really came back. One of the big things in the catalyst behind Monster Beverage is the whole idea of, well, we have the potential for a buyer. Coca-Cola has invested a lot of money in us. They're looking for growth. So you have this as the backdrop. Now, with that as the backdrop, and when you have this distribution going on with Coca-Cola, their earnings have skyrocketed. Coke would have been very smart. They would have been very, very smart to buy a much larger piece of this company, if not the whole thing, way back, because we're talking about close to a 100% increase in value, in the value of the company over the last, I don't know, year and a half or 2 years. Monster Beverage really storming ahead pretty well with all of that going on, and this is with in a situation where you have the global headwinds of the dollar, right? They're doing well with that. The fact that we're seeing a slowdown in many of the other beverage industry areas, in terms of Coca-Cola and Pepsi, kind of a flat line in that whole area, and Staples seeing troubles because of all of the problems we noticed around the world, etc. And this company keeps on performing. Kind of like get a scratch your head and wonder, oh gosh, I hope nothing's going to like fall out of bed here and get some weird accounting situation happen here. But so far, so good. I mean, really, the company's been doing very, very well. So that's good news. All right, what else do we have to talk about? We talked about Apple. We talked about the watch coming up next week. We have, I think it's the 9th they're coming up with a pre-announcement before the release of all about, you know, what's going to happen with the watch. I think the big thing that you need to look at here is this. Will it be waterproof? Or somehow, it's got to be, right? I mean, do you think Apple's going to make a watch that's not waterproof? And the reason for that is that if you want to have an everyday instrument, an everyday device that you're going to wear, and a lot of people want to swim or, you know, take a shower or, you know, even a high degree of rain on it could be a problem. Right now, I don't know about you, but if I get any water on my iPhone or my, you know, my iPad or whatever, I'm you know, I rush right away, get it dry, clean it up, make sure it's taken care of. Well, what about the watch? Is the watch going to be that delicate as well? Do we have the same problem with the watch that we have with the iPhones and other smartphones? Or not every smartphone, because obviously the Samsung has that licked a little bit. They have a waterproof device. But right now, I think that one of the big things that I want to see, I know it's a small item in the big picture and, you know, in terms of tethering and or in terms of battery life, I want to see if it's going to be actually weatherproof, waterproof. I think it's going to be a big issue when it comes to this. So take a look at all of that. Also, make sure that you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The information, I think I mentioned this, the Aero has been updated. That's our strategy where we're going to be algorithmically trading in and out of the S&P 500. Right now, actually, we're getting a turning point that it looks like on the S&P 500. We've been long since about January, I think, 10th, I think it is, or so. And we're getting a little turning point right now and hasn't confirmed yet, but there is something happening with the Aero algorithm that we have been noticing. If you want more information about this and historical returns and things like that, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's a button that says Aero on there somewhere. Click on that. Or if you want any information about any of the other things that we do, or if you want to ask me a question, ask Andrew at The Disciplined Investor. Follow me on Twitter. Andrew Horowitz is the handle, nickname. Thanks for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.